Today's episode of the Plants Are People 2 podcast is brought to you by the MOAM Empowerment Organization of America. We're here to MOAM North America and empower you to take the rest of your life off from purchasing MOAMs. But what will I do with all this free time? You ask. Well, while you're saving your MOAM money, buy native seeds from a native plant supplier in your eco-region or collect native aster seeds from around your habitat. They're easy to grow, will come back year after year, they make more seeds. They're good for pollinators in the end of the growing season and they're fucking gorgeous. Do your part and cut out the MOAMs today. I'm perfect in an empty room. Four dogs in the distance. Each stands for a kindness, yeah. Bluebirds lodged in an evergreen. All drunk gonna shine out in the wild. I'm gonna shine out in the wild silence. I'm gonna shine out in the wild silence. And spurn the sin of giving in. Oil paintings of X-rated picnics. Behind the walls of medication, I'm free. Every leaf in a compact mirror hits a target that we can't see. Grass grows in the icebox. The year ends in the next room. It is autumn and my camouflage is dying. Instead of time, there will be lateness. Instead of time, there will be lateness. Instead of time, there will be lateness, and let forever be delayed.
Hey, 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 welcome back to the Plants Are People 2 podcast. It's been a while since I have recorded a show. I've been thinking about you all, though, and getting messages from a lot of people that have been listening, so that's been great. I put up probably 25 or 26 episodes before I had to take a break. And my season started, my work season, outside, so that kind of took priority over my wintertime when I was spending it recording podcast episodes and doing office work. So here we are in October, October 7th, 2022. Gonna be doing a little talking today about MOAMs, Native Plant Conference in North Carolina, how this season's been going, some highlights from that, Symphotrichium, and some other asters that are out there right now since things are still flowering and it hasn't frosted at my house yet, although I live at 1600 feet, which is an advantage because usually all the valleys frost first and then we get an extended sort of season. So I have some special things in the garden right now that I picked up that I'll tell you about from the Native Plant Conference that I was told would not flower until late October or November. So you know, here we are, they're outside, they're budding up. I hope that we don't get frost before I can see them. And you can hear CeCe in the background doing a good job being quiet. Hey, buddy, how are you? So let's start out with the Native Plant Conference in Cullowhee, North Carolina. That happened in July of this year, 2022. It happens in the middle of July. I'm not sure what the dates are going to be next year. But I was a first-timer to that conference. I went with Nathan from Wild Bud Natives, who told me about it the year September before, and it sounded really cool. So I jumped on the bandwagon and bought a ticket. It was supposedly had the highest turnout since like 1993 or something. But that's partially due to the COVID years, you know, amping people up to get together again and like hang out. So there's about 400 people that go or so. There's a bunch of vendors. There's a really cool bookstore that vends there called City Lights, that's local to Cullowhee or Silva, North Carolina. And they just bring plant books from all different regions. Nathan was in Wildbud was vending there. I helped them do some load in and load out. And he was selling plants. Everyone there sells native plants only. They had some really cool selections, and there were classes going on all the time. My favorite part was like getting out into the woods in the surrounding area and being able to like see what plants were occurring in that habitat, because I lived there probably about 8 or 10 years ago now, and I wasn't really tuned into plants when I was living there. And so now it's kind of a trip for me to go back and explore all those places that I've been before, but I was like mountain biking or hiking, and I really wasn't interested in the minutiae of what plants were occurring in those habitats. So I got to see some really cool stuff that I really had no idea sort of ever existed, which was really fascinating for me. It was like almost every place that I could go, I would run into some new species, sometimes a new genus, but sometimes those species were, you know, that I was used to seeing were in genera that I would see in Vermont, New England, but they would be slightly different, or growing at like 6,000 feet, which would be an alpine zone there, and that area is a rare habitat for a lot of their plants. So you would find like St. John's wort, you know, a Hypericum species, but it would be like the Appalachian or the Blue Ridge St. John's wort, and there's some, you know, that's one of the only places that plant is occurring, you know, in the world, which is an amazing thing to just be part of with a bunch of other people that are into plants. Everyone there was super friendly, met a bunch of really nice people. One of the most amazing talks that happened that weekend was by Trad Cotter, and he's a mushroom guy, a fungi guy, but he was talking about like biological controls for insects that we would have, you know, invasive insects or just pests, native pests that we would have that might be out of control in certain areas. He was talking about finding, I'm sure that some of you are familiar with the, there was like a, maybe it was National Geographic or something on YouTube maybe, but it was about zombie ants, and the short of that whole movie was that there's this fungus that will get into an ant. Part of its life cycle is to go in and coat the brain of the ant in sort of this like chemical, you know, puppet mastery of their brain, control them, cause them to crawl up high onto something like a leaf surface or a tree, and then the fungus will kill the insect host, and then it will fruit out of its desiccating body. And because it sort of crawled up somewhere high, it has maximum elevation to be able to disperse its spores further to reproduce. So, and the other thing about these is they're very specific. So he gave some sort of anecdotal reference to, I think it was like a fire ant population, that they found one of these mummified ants on a leaf tip. And the leaf tip was important because, you know, in the morning, that's sort of where the dew will settle. And so that would be the most moist part of that little micro habitat, microclimate for that fungus to reproduce. So it's almost like there's like a ton of thought that goes into these things. And if you look up on Google, do like an image search for these, some of them are like really pretty iridescent colored, and sort of the way that it manipulates the insect into the final stance that it has before it dies. Some of them look like, you know, Egyptian sphinxes, and they're really elegant looking things. But then all these little almost trichomes, you know, lollipops coming out of the head of the insect or the body, which are the fruiting bodies of that fungus. But so these are very specific funguses for fungi for insects. And so if you found one on, let's say, the spotted lanternfly or the emerald ash borer or a tent caterpillar or any other invasive insect that you can think of, the likelihood of that fungus being a really good biological control for that insect and specific to that insect, because as we know, through time, we've tried to do biological controls for insects and other pests in the past by introducing something else, and historically that's failed. There's probably, I don't know, a handful of instances where that actually worked and it didn't cause more destruction than we thought it would, or than the original pest infestation. But these would be native fungi to our area that you could then, once you find that mummified insect, you would culture it. So putting it onto agar, like a microbiology class, and then you get more of that and you sort of you put it into a slurry, dilute it, and then you spray it out into your, you know, wherever you're trying to control that particular insect for. And it should be a relatively benign biocontrol for a very specific targeted insect. So that was a really encouraging talk. I'm sure that if you searched Trad, TRADCOTTER, Cotter, you could find, I'm sure he's done that talk before. It's probably on YouTube. But he's really engaging. He's funny. And so we went on a plant walk on one of the final days of the conference. This conference is it's probably about 4 or 5 days long. We went out on a plant walk with him, and there was a lot of people there, so it was easy to get sort of lost. It was hard to keep up. And so I was sort of looking at plants the entire time, which I saw a lot of really cool plants. And I was you know, everyone there is a plant person, so when you see something cool, you can just turn around and, you know, show it to somebody and be like, hey, look at this thing, this is awesome. And, you know, I knew a lot of what I was looking at there just because it's very similar to the New England area, although it has more species of things and some, you know, lots of different ones too, but I at least had a good foothold on what, you know, family or genus I was looking at. And so we were walking down the trail, we found some really cool orchids, Tripularia, and then I came across one of the plants that I've sort of been looking for a long time up here, and I know it occurs around here, Triosteum, T-R-I-O-S-T-E-U-M, which is, and it's, I forget that this one that I saw there was Perfoliatum. There's like 3 or 4 species, but it's called the orange-fruited horse gentian, and all right, my throat's getting dry. Orange-fruited horse gentian. It's got opposite leaves, so it's in the honeysuckle family. It's not a gentian at all, but it has, you know, the stem comes right through a set of leaves, and then in the axils of those leaves are orange reddish flowers in the spring. It's an early bloomer, and then as fall comes around, the fruits turn bright orange, and they're striking. Then the seeds actually look like you know, almost like a really wrinkly coffee bean. They're about the same size. And it was at one time used as sort of a coffee substitute. So, but up here, it's listed as, in Vermont, it's listed as uncommon. I forget the other state statuses. But I think down in Massachusetts, it's really, it's not listed at all. So it has a S4 designation, which is fairly widespread, which means it's not rare or anything. But I have never seen it in the woods up here. I've looked at iNaturalist observations for it. I've tried to go find it. I've had no luck. But on this trail, right around Western Carolina University, I happened to see the fruits, and they weren't orange yet, they were green, but they were all flowering around the axles, and they were all showing up around the axles, and so I picked it out, and then I showed a few people there, and I was like, this is a really special plant, like, I've never seen this in the, you know, in the wild before, I've only ever seen pictures of it, and there was a guy there, and I forget what his name was, I think his name was Rick, he's from, the South Carolina Botanical Society. He might be their president, but he was a really knowledgeable guy, really laid back. I showed it to him, and he asked me what it was, so I told him, and he said, he was like, I don't think I've ever seen that plant in the, you know, at all, and I can't remember the last time I saw that plant. And then later, I asked him about it. I ran into him as I was leaving, and I was like, oh, what did you think of that horse gentian? And he was like, man, I couldn't remember. I was trying to tell other people what the name of that thing was, and I couldn't remember what you said it was. But he was impressed by that plant, as we all should have been. So that, actually, I have been looking for it around here. I haven't found it yet. I keep my eyes open. I'm curious about, you know, through this Collinsonia, the Canada horse bomb research that I did, that I just finished, actually. I'm sort of putting together my maps now. Over the summer, I've really been paying attention to habitats and sort of plants indicating for other plants. And I really want to see that horse gentian in the wild in Vermont or New England and find out what other plants it's growing around so I can sort of keep my eye open for it. It's kind of a... I mean, the plant that I saw was like three or four feet tall, and so they kind of look like everything else. They kind of look like a milkweed leaf. It's kind of big and wide, and it has that same texture to it. So I wonder if some of those are getting mistaken for milkweeds, although the habitat's probably different, so, but maybe not for poke milkweed. So there's a lot of, I need to like visually get a grasp on what those other plants are that are around it, and then I think I would think about that and where I've seen those other associated plants and start to, you know, put my finger on where I could find it in Vermont if it's still here. Other things that happened at that, the Native Plant Conference, it's a really like laid back situation. You stay in dorm rooms if you want to. You know, you could get an Airbnb in town. Silva is really cool. It's got like a couple bars, breweries, barbecue place, and of course has an Ingles, and the most important thing, a Bojangles. I probably went to Bojangles like 4 times when I was there. If you've never been to a Bojangles and you're in North Carolina or South Carolina or Tennessee, or Virginia, I think. They might even have one in like Indiana, but if you've never been to a Bojangles, go to Bojangles, get a chicken biscuit, and get Bo Round, and get a sweet tea. You will not regret it. It is like, those are some of the best, that's some of the best like fast food that I've ever had. And the fact that you can get it on a biscuit is like amazing. So it's really laid back, you know. They have a happy hour at like 4 or 5 o'clock every afternoon up in the like mezzanine of the like stadium, the indoor stadium that they have for basketball or whatever. And so they give you like a couple beers or drinks or wine or whatever you want before dinner, and then they serve dinner. And then at night, they sort of have bands play. There was a bluegrass band. I was kind of in and out of that stuff, so I missed some of it. But Then there's usually like people hanging out outside, and if you're into plants, you know, everyone just hangs out outside with beers, or they smoke joints, or you know, whatever you want to do in the parking lot, and just talk about plants and like what you're doing, what you're interested in. It's a really cool like scene, especially for like a college campus. There was one story that I heard in bits and pieces, but it was, they had like a moonshine bar in the back of a pickup truck, and I never actually saw that, because I think I'm not really a liquor drinker, but you know, seeing that, I probably would have tried some of them, because it was like, it wasn't like just regular like blueberry moonshine or like, you know, peach moonshine. It was like sassafras moonshine and like, oh, I don't, black birch moonshine, and you know, there was just a cool bunch of really botanical influenced moonshines to like take part in and try. And so there was one person who was there that the ambulances came that night, and they apparently partook in the moonshine bar and then blacked out in the shower, and their body covered the drain and flooded the third floor, which then flooded the second floor, which then flooded the first floor. I was on the third floor, and I never, and it must have been on the other side of the wing or something, because I never saw any water. But they were a really shallow shower, so, and she's okay, so I, you know, last I heard, everything was fine, which is good. So there's, you know, any type of thing you want to do, like that place was, that was probably one of the best weeks that I've spent in North Carolina, and I've spent a lot of weeks in North Carolina. The other, Nathan and I also went out to, we were trying to find, I wanted to find a sebacea species, I didn't care which one, which is in the gentian family, which if you haven't seen, you should look those up on Google, sebacea, S-A-B-A-T-I-A, they're really cool. The one we saw was angularis, and they have those twisted petals, just like the other gentian family plants would have. They're pink, yellow center. There's some that occur out on like Cape Cod, which they're rare. It's Kennedyana. It's like, it has Kennedy, and I think it's I-A-N-A at the end of it. Kennedyana. It's a weird name. I'm sure they named it after the person who found it, but they occur in these sandy areas, and I've tried to grow it, and it really hasn't worked out. They didn't germinate this past spring, and I wonder if it's like, I'm going to talk about this in a future episode, as well as the Colinsonia canadensis research, but I think fresh seeds are the way to go. Like, I've been buying for years, just buying seeds, you know, in February or March, and normally, I guess they come in all at the same time. Sometimes if I buy them on, or I used to buy them on eBay or wherever, they, the year might not be known, and it, who knows how they're storing those seeds. I think the stuff I got from Prairie Moon was 2021 seeds, would have been from last year, maybe they were 2020. But so as somebody who's been harvesting seeds very recently, you know, and I am selling seeds, if any of you are interested, you can shoot me an email at plantsorpeopletopodcast@gmail.com, or hit me up on Instagram, plants.r.people.2, and just send me a message, and I'll send you the seed list that I have of native plants, with mostly a Vermont, New Hampshire ecotype, Massachusetts some, and you can, I've just been taking donations, so whatever you want to donate, I'm going to turn that money into plant research money for next summer, which will be another episode that I'll have some information on. I have some ideas on things that would be cool to like check out, so I'm trying to get some extra money to do some stuff like that, and then most of that will either get posted here or put on Instagram. And then everyone will sort of be a part of it. Also, I'm going to have stickers next Monday, the 24th, available. Plants or People 2 stickers with an Impatience compensis in the center. And it says, Be Rad and Plant Native. And then I have a straight up bumper sticker that's like 7.5 inches by 2.25 inches. Plants or People 2. So if you want any of those, I think they're going to be $5 each, and that'll get them shipped to you. And yeah, just hit me up on those two outlets if you want any of that stuff. But fresh seeds, so all that seed stock that I have right now, I'm going to sell it or get rid of it before the next season so that those seeds are in the ground this season. I don't know what happens to viability over time, as if you hear that, that's my dog Cecil taking her to vet right now, actually driving in the car. She listens to the podcast before they happen, but she's not feeling good, so sorry about that. So I think she's calmed down a little bit, so I'm back on. Yeah, sowing fresh seeds that you harvest, I think the best way to ensure a good germination rate is to plant those seeds as soon after you harvest them as you can, you know, as soon as those seeds are ripe. In nature, those seeds would get dispersed, carried by animals or the wind or ants or, you know, just gravity to the ground, and it would be in contact with soil almost immediately to go through the winter of a natural stratification period, cold and wet, and then germinate in the spring. So I'm reluctant now, as a seed collector and just thinker of plants, like, to buy seeds that aren't like fresh harvested from that season. So that's what I'm going to be providing, and hopefully, I think with a couple people I've talked to who will hopefully take the rest of my stock for this year, and then I'm going to start again the next season. So if there's anything that you're really looking for, I have a lot of cool stuff, nothing rare, obviously, because I'm not, as part of an ethical thing, harvesting rare plant seeds would be wrong and detrimental probably to the lifespan of those rare plants if they're, you know, not occurring in those areas very much. There might be a low viability rate for their seeds. They may not survive anyway, so, you know, that might be the best location for them. So a lot of the stuff that I have, is some of it's uncommon, and some of it's like pretty common. Some of it's what I suspect to be planted plants, but they're still native to our area and still good for native ecosystems and native pollinators. And they, for the most part, fit, you know, what those pollinators would be looking for. The other thing I'm offering, and sort of booking for right now in 2023, is if you're in New England and you would like a botanical survey of your property, or want to do sort of a one-on-one, or you and your family, or you and your friends, a plant walk of your property, I am booking those slots now for 2023 during the growing season. So that could be a one-day type thing. The other option there is to have a thorough botanical survey of your property, or you know, if you are part of an organization, a conservation commission, or the Nature Conservancy, somewhere where you're thinking about buying a piece of property or it's getting donated and you need a botanical survey of it, I am happy to offer that service. So feel free to reach me on either of those platforms. Additionally, if it's like New York or you know, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, I'm also interested in those areas. I would love an excuse to go down to New Jersey and go through somewhere like the Pine Barren. So just give me that excuse to get down there and I'll do it.
And the other thing is, New York isn't, you know, upstate New York isn't that far from where I live now, so I'm happy to entertain going up into those areas too. And a lot of what I've found about, you know, this past season where I haven't been doing a podcast and I've been in the woods every day, I found a number of, I started off in May finding rare or Artini species plants just randomly, either on the side of the road or on someone's property. And it's almost like, you know, if you, anyone out there who's listening to this, who's starting their botanical journey, trying to figure out how do I deed plants or how to look at native habitats, really the way to do that is, or the way that worked for me, is to be exposed to it, you know, on a regular basis. And a lot of it's just like, you know, me going for a walk in the woods in somewhere where I've been before, and I'm just like paying attention in a different way. And I've sort of, all of the really common things that you see everywhere, you stopped IDing those, and you see them and you're going through that name in your head, you know, it's, you're IDing them, but then you're looking at something and you're like, whoa, that looks completely different than this other species of this thing that I know is what it is. And then you start looking at those, and that's when you start finding really interesting plants that don't occur everywhere. And you sort of start seeing these other layers. And so a lot of things clicked for me this past season being in the woods, and just having, you know, 9 years of experience being in the woods. And then all of a sudden I was like seeing this whole different, it was like getting a different type of sight, which was really, it's powerful, because now wherever I go, I'm sort of keyed into these things that, I don't know. I don't think a lot of people are, you know, a lot of those rare plants I find on trailside, they haven't been reported before, and how many people walked, you know, by those before I saw them? Probably thousands. And so, like, I was the only one that actually thought that was interesting enough to, like, sit down and take a picture of and then go ID it and figure out what it was, and then maybe. But, so that possibility is really driving me right now. And those, you know, on anybody's pieces of property, you could find really special plants that would be so amazing if the landowners wanted to, you know, manage their land for those particular plants in mind. I don't think a lot of society's forestry's focus is on, you know, the herbaceous layer that happens in the understory, but those are, you know, a lot of the pollinator plants that are not just, you know, in the spring, that like most tree species are, and they're host plants for larvae, for insects, for, you know, beneficial insects that, you know, predate on things that would harm the tree. So like all of those things are interconnected, and really knowing what is in your understory, I think, is more valuable than what's in your overstory. So feel free to reach out on Instagram, or you can email me. I'd love to talk. It's getting into that time of year where the leaves are all falling right now. It's pouring rain, actually. Weather's getting cooler. I actually heard recently that this is going to be the second to last daylight savings time change, which is like, I was joking this morning that it would be great if they did away with it, and I haven't been like tuned into the news or anything, but somebody told me that the Congress decided that we were going to fall back in November and then spring ahead in April or whenever that happens, and then we're never going to do it again. We're just going to be on spring ahead time from here on out. So that should be an interesting milestone for us to navigate. I think it'll be a lot better. It's always kind of a fucky thing to have those time changes. And, like, I'd rather just be on the same thing all the time. So I'm glad that happened. The next thing that I was going to talk about today, Oh, yeah. So I've been casting a lot of shade recently on mums, and the reason why I do that is I feel a void in when I see like a Home Depot or these flower stands on the side of the road, and they're, you know, they could be big box stores or bigger companies, or maybe they're smaller companies and a mom and pop shop, which has a different reason why they're selling it, but it's sort of all related to the same thing, which is money. And these businesses are trying to make money off of like a traditional thing that they know people are going to buy. And the reason why people are buying it is because they're sort of like, you know, peer pressured into buying it. And it's sort of like, you know, they see pictures on Home and Garden of, you know, somebody's front door with pumpkins and the corn stalks and the mums sitting on the stairs, and they're like, I gotta have that. And it's been going on for a long time. We've had mums. It's been a horticultural, you know, interest for a while. And so chrysanthemums have been bred to be all these weird colors. And I respect the chrysanthemum in its native habitat. And I would love to go see a chrysanthemum in its native habitat. But these hybrids, and sort of like, they're created by, you know, humans to fulfill some want that the human has, which is like a particular color or pattern or shape or flowers profusely. And that's not necessarily the direction that evolution would have taken that plant in a much longer period of time than it took humans to change it, you know, by increasing the selection pressure so much that they shifted it towards, you know, a big, profusely flowering orange and white spotted chrysanthemum. And so that's, I see the, there's like this, it's kind of a double-edged sword. There's this interest in plants, but it's not, which is cool, like that's what we want, but it's like not the interest in plants that, it's not the level that you need people to be at, because they're looking at things that aren't real and like would never happen in nature. And so it's like further disconnecting people from nature by like trying to get them interested in nature, which is, to me, is like a weird, weird, you know, dichotomy of these two things together. And I just, so when I see mums on somebody's front porch or at the Dunkin' Donuts or like, you know, at Home Depot, I just cringe, because, you know, people are spending money on those things and they're not, I guess you can overwinter them if you stick them in the ground, but like, are the pollinators confused by what those things are, because they're not from this region? And then are they also confused by the coloration that has been, they've been transformed into? Are the number, to the number of flowers throw them, like, so there's so many questions about that. And really, like, those are aster plants. Chrysanthemums are asters. So like, we have a huge number of asters in our ecoregion in New England and all over the United States that would fulfill, they look, to me, they look better than chrysanthemums ever look. Chrysanthemums look fake. But these asters come in all different kinds of colors, all different kinds of leaf variation. They'll grow in really shitty habitat. They'll grow in like sand and like, you know, bedrock, you know, very shallow soils, poor nutrients. There's an aster out there for your place if you have one, or container. I had somebody on Instagram reach out to me about, you know, they got a little upset about the mum. I said fuck mums on one of my Instagram reels, and you know, I truly believe that. I would never buy a mum because they're hideous and they don't really do anything and it's a waste of money. But you know, I said you could plant any kinds of... Jesus Christ, CC. So I suggested that they could plant any Symphotrichium species, and, you know, they would come back every year. They're good for pollinators. The seeds are free because you could literally go probably anywhere around you live in September, October. Right now is a great time to collect seeds. Go around and pull off anything that, you know, if you saw it during the flowering time and you could ID it and you knew what it was, you would know what you were pulling. And then, you know, sow those around your house and, you know, fresh, like take them off the plant and then put them in the ground where you want them. They'll come back every year and you don't have to spend any money on them. And then if, you know, they flower that season, which some will, some won't, you can harvest those seeds and then plant more of them. And then you have, you know, an ongoing cycle that you never have to spend any money on. And I feel like the big box stores, mom and pop stores, do it because they probably have to make money, you know, and then it's all driven by this like societal need to fulfill some, you know, picture fantasy that you saw in a magazine or on TV or on like a Dunkin' Donuts commercial. Like, don't do that, you know, tell your friends not to do that. Like, if I feel like if we just stop purchasing things, you know, and we shift towards this other side of like native plants only, you know, eventually we would wear out that system. And there's like really, I mean, I guess they're the incentive is you save money. So, and you know, you're doing something good for the ecosystem that you're a part of. You know, we're all sort of invasive, except for the indigenous peoples who lived here or live here. And so, you know, we in theory shouldn't be here either. But so we're, you know, trying to do the best by the environment around you, I think, is the way to at least combat something in your lifetime. And not, you know, wasting your money on these things that are, I don't know. If anyone can give me, I mean, this person on Instagram said that, you know, they liked the color in the fall, and they thought that they wouldn't be able to grow these asters in like a 10-inch pot on their patio. They live in an apartment, so they don't have any land. And I suggested, you know, one thing you could do is plant native seeds on in a vacant lot near your house if you have one, or near your apartment. And the other thing is you just get a pot that's a little deeper. Like if you, I mean, you could do it in a 10-inch pot. I'm sure those asters would flower. You could get those to flower in a 10-inch pot. But if you just buy a, you know, one of those big planters and put it on your patio or whatever, or in your house in a lit room, you could watch those asters grow all year and then they'd flower in the fall. So, you know, mums should be on their way out. And I think we should start telling all the boomers that mums aren't cool anymore. What's cool now is native plants and native asters. And I want to talk about specifically the Symphotrichium species. I have been paying a lot of attention this season to them, and I've noticed there's like an interest in being able to tell them apart. And so I'll probably talk a little bit just about some species that I've seen, I've become familiar with, and then I might go through some of the key characteristics to differentiate some of them. Some of them I've never seen before. There's probably, I'm just guessing, but 27 Symphotrichium species in New England, and some of them are rare. I think there's probably a couple garden escapee non-native plants here and there in that 27, and then there's a bunch of native ones. And one thing I always think about with these asters is like, you know, Latin's kind of a funny thing because nobody ever really spoke it, and it's a dead language, and so it was, you know, implemented into the binomial nomenclature canon, and because it was never going to change, so that you know, the names would always mean something. And so a lot of the way that, you know, I learned how to say things was through you know, hearing other people say them. And sometimes there's species that I find that I've never heard anyone say, and so I sort of sound it out and then figure out, you know, what I think sounds right. And sometimes I'll like key it into you know, Google as pronunciation and just see what the AI will pronounce it like. And I don't know. So I think I add like an extra I in symphotrichum. I think I had an extra I at the end because I think it's symphotrichum, but I don't really like the way that sounds. So I just decided that I'm just gonna keep owning it and keep pronouncing it the way I pronounce it, and people will have to adapt, or I don't know, they'll agree with me. At least they'll probably know what I'm talking about. But the ones that I noticed a lot this year, one of them was the blue wood aster, which is cordifolium, one of those. It's the interesting thing about this plant is it's sort of like one of those morphologically different in different sort of habitats. I've seen ones that are really tall and sort of panicled flowers, so really stretched out flowers, you know, flower stems with the buds on them, and there'll be other ones that'll be in the understory, and they're short and squat, and they have really condensed flowers, and sometimes they almost look like they have a white center. Some of them have yellow centers that'll eventually turn to like a magenta center. And the leaves are what gives them away. They have sort of a, in the sinus, which is the back, the leaf, side of the leaf closest to the stem, sort of forms like the top of a heart shape. So it kind of curves back in towards the stem. There is another one that's a rare plant. It's called Lindy's aster, and that one has no curving on the back of the leaf, so it's just a flat back. And I've been looking for those because they're historical in Vermont, but I haven't found one yet. It seems like a really like easy ID characteristic to figure that out. So let's get into some Symphotrichium species in the New England area that you're probably familiar with, or you know, once you look them up, you've probably seen them around, but you didn't know what they were. A lot of them look very similar. I sort of think about them based on flower size. So how wide is that circular flower? Sort of what the leaf shape looks like, and then their growth habit. So are they sort of bushy? Are they tall and slender? And then additionally, also the habitat that they're growing in. So a lot of the plant ID stuff that I sort of think about when I'm... The first one would be the swamp aster, Symphotrichium panicum, which is ubiquitous almost everywhere. I see it all over the place. It is probably found in every county in New England. It has red stems. They have little clearish, almost like cloudy hairs on them. Sometimes the stems can be green, longer, strappy leaves. And then I most often see those in wetter areas, so along the sides of rivers, creeks, brooks. in wetlands, in wet meadows, old ag fields. Sometimes you'll see it along forest edges if it's maybe a little, you know, if there's a little wetland nearby. Those have all started going to seed right now, so that's a good one. If you've seen the purple, they're pretty big, you know, they're probably an inch and a half across, yellow centers. The petals can be pretty narrow, those are probably some of the easiest American aster seeds to grow, and they're, you can tell when the seeds are ripe because they'll fully expand into like a plume, and they'll start by wind dispersal leaving that seed head. So if you see those, if you've noticed purple asters around your house, it's probably either swamp aster or it's the New England aster, which has much smaller leaves, darker purple flowers. They are striking. New England aster is one of my favorites, I think, and I take pictures of it all the time because every time I see it, it looks so good. And those actually haven't ripened where I'm at right now. I've been checking. They are a longer flowered American aster. The swamp asters are still flowering here too, but they sort of started a little earlier, so I would have seen those flowering probably in August. And the New England aster really doesn't start flowering until, I don't know, middle of September maybe. And they come in two color variations, which is really cool. Two natural color variations, unlike the mums that have been bastardized for hundreds of years. They actually come in, the New England aster will come in a pink color as well. So I've seen some of those in the wild here and there, and it must be just a natural variation. But there's no other, I don't think there is any other like pink variant Symphotrichium species. Maybe there is. I'll have to look that up after I'm, you know, that's another good question. If anyone knows, send me a message. The other ones, so we talked about the blue wood aster, which is a purple one. The swamp aster, which is a purple one. New England aster, which is a purple one. The other ones that I see or have seen this year, Leyev, which is the smooth American aster. Now this I saw down in New Hampshire, on the coast of New Hampshire, which the soil type is way different. It's sort of a fire-adapted habitat, which as we all know, has been suppressed for a long time. They do a little burning there. But these were growing, it was a field where I was doing some treatment for Great Bay National Wildlife Refuge, doing some treatment of swallowwort and some other invasives, knotweed and phragmites in that area. But it was funny because we were treating swallowwort in a field of reed canary grass, which we're going to address later and try to help them get them on the right path in terms of what we should be treating there. But in the upper section of that field, there was Ionactus, which isn't a Symphotrichium, but let's come back to that. A different aster growing, you know, in that area that looks flower wise very similar to this one. But this particular Symphotrichium Leyev, L-A-E-V-E, was growing in really shallow, sandy, rocky soil with little blue stem. There were some Solidago species there that I didn't ID. And then, I forget. It was just like a really almost barren place. Just on this little rock outcrop above, a sea of reed canary grass and swallowwort next to the actual ocean. So, but that would be one that, you know, I'm not out there, so I'm not going to be able to collect seeds probably this year, but that one was a really cool one. The other one, which I saw at I do a little work every now and then for U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and we happen to be working down on the dam in Barre, Massachusetts, and they have a very similar habitat soil type to the coast, and so it's very sandy there. We saw like coastal jointweed, which is a really cool Polygonella species. I believe it's Polygonella articulata, which is has little white flowers on it. It grows all in the riprap there, along with Nuttallanthus canadensis, and there was the orange St. John's wort. I forget what it's like a really thin leaved jointed red stem St. John's wort that grows in that area. It's I forget the exact, let me see if I can find it, hold on a second. Called orange grass St. John's wort, and it's Hypericum gentianoides. So all those three little miniature plants were all growing sort of on this riprap. And then I found, it almost looked like it was fake at first, like it was a plastic plant sitting there. And so it wasn't in flower yet. It was just starting to bud, but I really wanted to see it in bud, in flower, just to see what it would look like, because I was sort of seeing it for the first time. But it's called Ionactis linearifolia, which is the flax-leaved stiff aster. And its habitat, its soil type, is sandy, rocky habitats in New England. It looks like we have, it occurs in like 4, 5, 6 counties in Vermont, one of them being in the county that I live in, and the county north of that, Windham and Windsor County. But in Vermont, it just says present, and I've never seen that. So, I mean, I'd have to get out and see if I can actually find that plant. And, but this one has, purple flowers, and it has foliage that is, it looks like rosemary leaves would be what I would describe it as. But it has beautiful purple, they're probably similar size, maybe a little smaller than the swamp aster flowers. But Ionactis, Ionactis. I was actually, when I first found this plant, I thought it was funny because I put it on iNaturalist and I was like, oh, it says Lonactis, Lonactis. And I was like, that's funny that both iNaturalist and GoBotany and the internet all put this as a lowercase letter. And then I was like, wait a second, that's an I. And it's I, so I don't know. I've just never really run into a lot of plants that started with the letter I. So Ionactis, and this was the one I was actually thinking of as like the alternative to the mum is Ionactis, because it has that like, rosemary type foliage that's really interesting and cool to touch. And then it has really beautiful aster flowers in the fall. And so I got to see this in flower at Great Bay National Wildlife Refuge, growing next to my favorite Trichostoma decotamum and the coastal jointweed, Polygonella articulata, and Nuttallanthus was there as well, canadensis. So all of those species. And so when I start, this is getting back to that species composition, sort of looking for other plants. When I see sand and I see that coastal jointweed and forked blue curls, I start thinking of these other plants, and then I start finding them there. And then you can start, you'll see the little differences that happen, like at that Berry Falls Dam, there's some rare plants there that they probably occur. I think I read about a study recently on Liatris nova anglae, which is the New England blazing star, which is endemic to New England. And they were trying some reintroduction programs in Middlesex County, which is where I'm originally from in Massachusetts. And that was probably the largest known population was there in Middlesex County. So they've tried reintroducing it in certain places. And, you know, thinking back to being a kid, that place was like, you know, a sandbox. I remember there being sand everywhere. But that, you know, those habitats, when you start making those connections of different things, that's when, like, if you would ever go to a habitat that had those plants and you know about Liatris nova anglae, you might see that in vegetation. It's probably pretty hard to tell apart from anything else, but we don't really have any Liatris species up here that are native except for that one. You know, and if you're out in a sandy habitat in the middle of nowhere and you see these things, like, you're probably finding a new unreported population of this plant in New England, and it's important for that information to be shared with people who can try to help protect it. Other Symphotrichium species, the other two that I think would be valuable to touch on here is Symphotrichium lanceolatum, which is the lance-leaved American aster. That is another one that I see a lot of. It's a white flower, has similar red stems to Panicum. This one has sort of longer leaves at the base of the stem where the flowers are protruding from, and then smaller leaves up that stem. But that's another one that occurs in every county in New England. Would probably do really well in any sort of growing situation. I see it all over the place. Very common. The other one that is kind of similar to that also has white flowers. And this one is a little different in that the flowers are smaller. But these two can get sort of mistaken for each other. And this one is Symphotrichium lateriflorum, which is the calico American aster. This one has similar longer leaves off the stem and then small flowers running up. But this one I really think about this one as being like, has a lot more flowers to it, and it's a little bushier. The flowers are smaller and they sort of change color from yellow to purple as they get older. But this one is also another one that probably grows, you know, this is native all the way out to Texas. So it is a super common plant. And so if you want to find out any more about any of these species in here, that other one that I mentioned that was historical in Vermont that I'm looking for is called Lindley's American Aster Symphotrichium ciliolatum. And it's found in Massachusetts, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, forest edges. It's often confused with the blue wood aster, cordifolium. And so they're distinguished by the fact that when stem leaves of Lindley's American aster have petioles, they are winged. Wings are very narrow or absent in petioled stem leaves of heart-leaved American aster. So, you know, keep your eyes open, look at the pictures of both of those and see if you can pick out what the differences are, but that's a good one to keep an eye out for. And I was going to go into, you know, more of a dichotomous key version of what these Symphotrichiums, how they broke out, but I think, you know, if you learned those five common ones that I threw out there, or you start to learn the common ones that are around you and be able to ID those, you know, on site, you'll start seeing the other ones that sort of filter through and you'll start finding some different species of that. One interesting thing, the first dichotomous break in the Symphotrichium genus is there's three species that are annuals and then 24 that are perennials. And so, you know, one of the three Symphotrichium species that are annuals are Ciliatum, Frondosum, and Subulatum, and then everything else is a perennial. So all the ones that I talked about today on this podcast were perennial species, so they will come back every year. Those other ones I'm not super familiar with. Some of them might be, you know, planted or garden escapees. And then also, just as a reminder, if you're in places that are strange, like a bog, Or a really cool wetland, some place that you might suspect you're going to see different kinds of plants. Keep your eyes open for those particular asters that grow in those places, because there are American asters that are American bog asters that will only be occurring in those sort of situations. So if you happen to be in one of those places or around one in September, they're always cool to check out because you'll see a new species of plant there for sure. The other one that I was really excited to talk about, and I think I teased it in the very beginning of the show, was I wanted to talk about Symphotrichium georgiana. So this is a Symphotrichium species from the southern part of the United States. It's only known from Alabama, South Carolina, Georgia, obviously, and in Florida. So Florida, it's been extirpated from, so it no longer exists there. But this species is Symphotrichium georgianum, and I happened to come across this plant, I think last winter, and I don't know that I had ever, maybe I saw someone post a picture of it or something, but I was like, whoa, these are, the flowers on these just look so vibrant and purple, and they sort of have a white center to them. I was instantly enthralled. And then at the native plant conference this summer, I was walking around and I happened to be listening to this guy, Ian, and I forget what the name of his business was, but he was out of Tennessee, I think. If you really want to know, you can reach out to me and I'll get it to you. He doesn't have an Instagram, so he's hard to like tag in anything or give him credit for it, but I'll give him credit here. I overheard him giving a little talk to some people, and he said georgianum, and I was like, I want that. And so I waited and then went up to him like the next day, and I was like, hey, you know those plants that you had? So he was like, oh, these are a rare plant. And I was like, I know that. And I forget, he told me where he got the seed, and it sounded legit, so I bought them from him. And then I took them home. I drove back to Vermont from North Carolina with them and then planted them. I put one in the greenhouse and one outside. And he, you know, Ian, when I bought them, said that I probably wasn't going to get to see them flower because they flowered in late October, November. And I knew that, you know, our falls are getting increasingly warmer here, so we sort of have this extended growing season, if you would call it that. So last summer, you know, it was sort of like until middle of November, it was like warm up here, warm-ish, not as cold as it has been in the past. And we don't, like, I've gotten a light frost at my house, but just down on the cars and not up on, like, my garden's kind of hillside, so I haven't had any frost hit that garden yet. The georgianum in the greenhouse is not budding, although it is doing very well. The one that I planted out, you know, sort of exposed in the garden, which it probably gets a little more sun there, is budding up. And it is, I don't know how many days or weeks I have until it actually flowers, but I'm like biting my nails hoping that it will go to flower. And ideally, I would be able to like get some seeds off those, so I might have to hand pollinate them. But that got me interested in thinking about, like, you know, what are the plants that are really late flowers that flower late here? And so I've sort of been watching the landscape to see what is still flowering. We get a lot of plants that like do a second round of flowers. Like I found some dogwoods recently that were flowering again in September, which was interesting. Golden Alexanders, which I hope to do some part of an episode on soon. Those I've seen double flower, so flower again in September. Those are great little plants if you can find native seeds of them. I will try to find some myself and collect some for people if they want. The blue wood aster is still flowering. All of the Eurybias, the white wood asters are still flowering. Goldenrods are pretty much all past now. There's still some that will put out double flowers. Clover is still flowering. But that's, I mean, I was thinking that there was going to be something that I could find out there that would be like, you know, this plant only flowers, you know, in November, and it only flowers because we only get warm Novembers every 5 years or something. And it was going to be something that I could go like hunt and try to find. But I think what I did was I brought that plant to Vermont from North Carolina via Ian, and now I'm waiting for my Symphotrichium georgianum to flower, because I can't wait to take pictures of it. It's an amazing one. If you look that up, be amazed at the flowers of that one. But so this is a really rare plant in, you know, the United States. It only occurs in those four states. Used to be five states. It's in North Carolina too, probably out on the coast. And there's only, at least from Wikipedia, it says that there's only 146 populations, and this plant community depends on natural disturbance such as wildfire, now largely destroyed or degraded by fire suppression and the removal of certain large grazing mammals. So it says it's a relic species of this historic ecosystem and grows in remaining woodlands. So that, you know, I don't know a whole lot about the oak pine barrens down there, but it sounds like it's, you know, with people moving in and changing the habitat, putting up houses and concrete and roads and parking lots, a lot of that habitat gets destroyed, and there's a lot of special plants there. So hopefully I can, you know, get some seeds off this and then share it with you all. It happens to be doing fine in, you know, zone 5. So I think it's rated for zone 4, which is interesting. So we could, you know, that would be a really cool native plant to be planting in your garden. You know, and it might not flower every year, but it every other year, every couple years, or maybe with the way that climate change is going, we're going to be, you know, that'll be like a species that we're going to get flowering every year. But I hope to be able to share photos with that with you all on Instagram pretty soon. Yeah, I guess that's bringing us around to the end of our episode. I am looking forward to continuing to make some episodes over the rest of the fall and then into the winter and then into the spring. We'll see what happens with, you know, what I do next year, but I imagine I will be in the woods again all next year. So this might be like a podcast that I do, you know, only in the winters, which works for me. If it works for you, I appreciate y'all taking the break with me and then coming back. I think a lot of you probably are interested in plants and understand the, like, you know, urgency with the growing season and need to get things done, and the slowdown in the winter when you have sort of more of a break from looking at plants and doing all the plant work that we all do out there. So, but again, if you guys want to reach out for seeds or stickers or